2 Samuel chapter 19. We're going to focus on a set of verses between 24 and 30. Let me go ahead and read the verses, and then I'll catch us up to the context of this particular event in David's life, how it fits into the bigger picture of what's going on during this time. But let's read from verse 24. And Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king. He had neither taken care of his feet, nor trimmed his beard, nor washed his clothes, from the day the king departed until the day he came back in safety. And when he came to Jerusalem to meet the king said to him, "Why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth?" He answered, "My lord, O king, my servant deceived me, for your servant said to him, 'I will saddle a donkey for myself, that I may ride on it and go with the king, for your servant is lame.' He has slandered your servant to my lord the king. But my lord the king is like the angel of God. Do therefore what seems good to you. For all my father's house were but men doomed to death before my lord the king. But you set your servant among those who eat at your table. What further right have I then to cry to the king?" And the king said to him, "Why speak any more of your affairs? I have decided you and Ziba shall divide the land." And Mephibosheth said to the king, "Oh, let him take it all, since my lord the king has come safely home." All right, we're in a circumstance in which David is still returning. In this encounter, he's actually now returned to the city of Jerusalem. He's been gone, not by his own choosing, but by the Lord's hand. He was gone because of the rebellion of his son Absalom, who stole the kingdom from him and who drove him out of the city of Jerusalem. And David, we saw, took refuge in the wilderness to the east across the River Jordan. And by the Lord's graciousness and mercy, David and the loyal troops that followed him into his exile in the wilderness did gain victory over Absalom and over his rebellious forces. And now that battle is over and Absalom is dead under the judgment of the Lord, David is on his way back. He's crossing the River Jordan in this sequence of events in this chapter, back into the Promised Land, back toward the city of Jerusalem, to be restored to his rightful place as king. But I said that, of course, that he's in this situation by the Lord's hand, and that's because we're still dealing with what we've identified as long-term consequences of a serious sin that he had committed, actually a pair of sins. He had committed the sin of adultery with Bathsheba, and then, of course, had compounded that sin by trying to cover his tracks by arranging for the murder of her husband. And the Lord had mercifully forgiven him, and the Lord had mercifully restored him to fellowship with him. And yet the Lord had also ordained long-term consequences, not just to make David pay, but to train David's heart so that he would never cross those lines again, to teach him deep and painful lessons. And as part of those consequences, we saw that the Lord said that the sword would never depart from his house. And he has experienced a sequence of events in which there have been painful lessons. The most recent and the most painful for him, of course, was the death of his most favorite son, Absalom, his closest son, the one that he loved and cared for most deeply. So now he's returning after the aftermath of the short war of rebellion with Absalom. And on his way back, we've identified that there's an interesting sequence or series of encounters that David has with key individuals. On his way from the wilderness safe place to the city of Jerusalem, as he's journeying back home, there are five key individuals that meet him on the way home. And each one of these meetings represents for us, and for David, of course, message from the Lord. The Lord is still speaking to David. He's still working in David's heart and life. He's still working sovereignly through what we might consider to be, at first surface glance, random chance encounters. But we understand in the way that the Lord oversees our lives, there are no such things as random encounters, chance events in our lives. The Lord is in charge of all circumstances in our lives and is working redemptively to accomplish things even through seemingly random events in our lives. And so David has a series of five encounters, and what we identified in our previous study is that it's very interesting, if we notice the big picture pattern of what's going on here, is that as David was being driven out of the city of Jerusalem, as he was fleeing Absalom, fleeing the city into the wilderness, he also had a series of encounters, key, meaningful message from the Lord type encounters. And there happened to be five of those on the way out of the city. And now as he's returning back, there's a series of five encounters. Now, I'd like to read just to start. We read 2 Samuel 19, but let's turn for a moment. We'll come right back to 2 Samuel. Let's turn to the book of Psalms. I don't remember whether I read this in our study last month or not, but it's well worth reading again, even if I did. And it's Psalm 121. And I want to read this in terms of just the big picture of what's going on in this sequence of encounters. The five encounters on the way out of the city, the five encounters on the way back into the city. And the principle that's proclaimed in this psalm is definitely applying now in this moment in David's life. This is from a set of psalms. You know, all of the psalms are worship songs that are inspired by God to help the people of God in their worship, to give spiritual and theological direction to their worship. But this particular psalm is part of a smaller group of songs known as the Songs of Ascent. The Songs of Ascent were songs that were in particular written for the children of Israel as they were traveling each year up to the city of Jerusalem in order to worship the Lord in the God-ordained feasts that really gave a framework and a direction to their yearly worship, the calendar year's worship that God had ordained in his law. There was a set of songs, these psalms, that the pilgrims returning to the city of Jerusalem to worship the Lord each year would sing these songs on the journey. As they were walking to the city of Jerusalem, they would sing this particular set of songs. And one of them is Psalm 121. I want to read the entire psalm. I do believe it applies to what's going on in David's life circumstances. I lift up my eyes to the hills. From where does my help come? My help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth. He will not let your foot be moved. He who keeps you will not slumber. Behold, he who keeps Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord is your keeper. The Lord is your shade on your right hand. The sun shall not strike you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord will keep you from all evil. He will keep your life. The Lord will keep your going out and your coming in from this time forth and forevermore. Now, there's a sequence of wonderful declarations in this psalm, but I want to focus in particular on the last one in verse 8. The idea that the man who's life is defined by a special relationship with the Lord. And that special relationship, you know, is biblically described for us as a covenant relationship. A relationship where there have been vows made. A relationship where there's been a formal relationship of deep and committed love established between the Lord and that individual. Of course, it's all ultimately initiated by the Lord, but it's responsibly something that should be in our hearts back toward him. And in that kind of relationship, the Lord makes certain commitments to us as those who are in covenant relationship with him. And one of those commitments is the Lord will keep, and this keeping has to do with watching over carefully for the purpose of guarding and protecting and keeping safe. The Lord will keep your going out and your coming in from this time forth and forevermore. And that's where David's at right now. His circumstance is He's just been driven out of the city of Jerusalem, and now he's being brought back into the city of Jerusalem. Looking from the outside in, you might say it's just the ebb and flow of random and powerful circumstances working upon his life. But David should understand this is the Lord's hand. It was the Lord's hand that drove him out through the circumstances connected to the rebellion of his son Absalom, and it's now the Lord that is bringing him back in. And in all of these circumstances, the Lord is involved, and he's fully engaged. And so as he has these encounters, the five encounters going out, the five coming back in, what he should be tuned to pick up on is, what is the Lord doing in each one of these encounters? And I want to be sure that I'm tracking with him in each one of these circumstances. We identified on the sequence of encounters going out of the city that each one of those five encounters served a purpose. And the purpose was either to encourage David's heart or to provide a spiritual test for David's heart. And the encounters coming back in are serving the same pair of purposes. The Lord is either encouraging David's heart in each one of these encounters, like the next one, which we will study, Lord willing, next month, is an encounter with Barzillai. And he is a very encouraging encounter for David's heart. But this one, this encounter with Mephibosheth, and actually I'm going to link this with the second encounter in our set of five, the encounter with Ziba. In both of these encounters on his way back into the city, these are testing encounters. They're going to put David's heart to the test. So that, and this is a general principle that applies all the way, not just in David's life, all the way through all of the testing circumstances of God's people throughout Scripture, and it applies to our lives as well. When God tests a man's heart, and we're talking about a man who's in covenant relationship with the Lord, why does the Lord test his heart? There are passages that describe, for instance, that the Lord put this man to the test to see what was in his heart. And that is Scripture using what we call, it's a theological principle called anthropomorphism, in which we're describing what the Lord is doing from a human perspective, but we need to understand something even above and beyond that practical description. When the Lord puts someone to the test, it's not in order for the Lord to discover what's in our hearts, because why? We already know that the Lord knows what's in our hearts before the test even occurs. So the Lord gives a test in order to bring out to the surface for the man himself to be able to see and to understand what's hidden in his own heart. The truth is, our hearts are like deep wells. And there are things in all of our hearts that we tend to hide from our own perspective or are hidden from our own perspective. And in order for us to grow, in order for us to get from point A to point B, where we start to where the Lord actually wants us to be, it's necessary for us to be able to see what's in our hearts from clear spiritual perspective, the perspective that the Lord himself sees our hearts in. In order for us to cooperate with what the Lord is after, the goal and purpose of what he's working to accomplish in our lives. So this is a circumstance, we can turn back to 2 Samuel 19. This is a circumstance in which the Lord is committed as a sovereign covenant Lord in David's life to keep him during all of his going outs and all of his coming ins, but at the same time, while he's going out, and while he's coming in, the Lord has arranged this sequence of critically important encounters, each encounter being a message from the Lord to deal with something in David's heart that David himself doesn't yet fully see. Now, the two encounters we're focused on today are Ziba and Mephibosheth. Now, we read the encounter with Ziba earlier in our previous study. We didn't stop and focus on it because it's what we could call a silent encounter. The encounter with Mephibosheth includes a whole conversation and interaction between David and Mephibosheth. And the one with the next man on the list or in the chapter is going to be a long, conversation that occurs. But the Ziba encounter happens while David's returning to the city without any words being exchanged. Let's go back and read that in verses 17 and 18, same chapter. 2 Samuel 19, And we'll read from verse 17. And with him, I'll read verse 16 just to get the flow. And Shimei, who we studied last month, the son of Gera, the Benjamite from Bahurim, hurried to come down with the men of Judah to meet King David. This is as David is crossing the River Jordan back into the Promised Land. And with him were 1,000 men from Benjamin. And Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul, with his 15 sons and his 20 servants, rushed down to the Jordan before the king. And they crossed the ford to bring over the king's household and to do his pleasure. And Shimei, the son of Gera, fell down before the king as he was about to cross the Jordan. So we kind of read over the involvement of Ziba last month and just focused on Shimei as the first great encounter. But David has an encounter with Ziba. He just doesn't have a conversation with him. And that encounter is going to serve a testing purpose for David because of what is going to take place in this next encounter with Mephibosheth that we're going to be studying today. So Ziba is playing a very particular and special role in this circumstance. Let's just remind ourselves of who Ziba was. Ziba was the number one servant of Mephibosheth, who is himself the grandson of Saul. He is the son of Jonathan, who is the son of Saul, who is the king that was king just prior to David. And Saul has died, the kingdom has been inherited by David, and yet there is this issue, this potential issue politically within the nation of who really deserves to be the king. Should it be a son of Benjamin, or should it be someone like David from an entirely different tribe and an entirely different household? And Mephibosheth normally would expect to, when a king in the ancient world is deposed, and especially deposed by someone from a different tribe, and the kingdom is inherited by someone from a different family, the heirs of the former king would normally expect to be put to death because they function in the society as potential rivals to the throne. But David was very gracious to Mephibosheth, and he was gracious toward Mephibosheth for a particular reason. Does anybody remember why, in a former time, in an earlier story that we studied, why did David show grace and mercy to Mephibosheth? For the sake of Jonathan, who was Mephibosheth's father, and who also happened to be David's closest friend, his true heart friend, his closest companion, a true brother in the Lord. And for the sake of Jonathan, who had died at the same time that his father Saul had died, David chose to show mercy and grace to his son as an expression of his love, his commitment, and his appreciation for his dear friend, Jonathan. And in doing so, in showing mercy to Mephibosheth, he did two things for him. One, he gave Mephibosheth rule or possession over all of the inheritance that belonged to Jonathan. He confirmed or affirmed legally that everything that belonged to Jonathan would remain in Mephibosheth's control rather than being taken into David's possession as the new king. And he gave Mephibosheth a place at his own table, meaning he gave him a dwelling place within the royal palace, and he gave him the right to sit and eat at his table, meaning I'm taking care of all your personal needs for the rest of your life. But at the same time, he had his own lands and his own properties, and so he ordained for Ziba, who was the servant of Mephibosheth, to take charge and kind of run the affairs of Mephibosheth, to be like the steward of the household, of the family, and to run the farm, so to speak, to run the land, to farm the land and to take care of it on behalf of Mephibosheth. So that's the backdrop. But then there was a circumstance during the rebellion of Absalom in which David had to flee the city. David was hurrying out of the city in order to get away from Absalom. And those who were closest to David, those who were loyal to him, those who were connected to him, all fled the scene with David. They fled the city along with him. And so we see in the exchange between David and Mephibosheth, you know, Mephibosheth, he asked Mephibosheth one question, why didn't you go with me? And Mephibosheth answered and said, I wanted to go with you. I attempted to go with you. I was arranging for a donkey to be made ready in order for me to be able to go with you because I couldn't walk to go with you. He had, of course, he was famous for having two lame feet. He had been dropped as an infant and had so injured his feet that he was not able to walk normally. And he said, I attempted to go with you. I wanted to go with you. What we saw in an earlier account was that when David was leaving the city, he was met in one of those five key encounters by Ziba, the servant, who came riding a donkey with a train of donkeys behind him, loaded with a gift of food and provisions for the wilderness journey for David and for his troops. And Ziba at that time said to David, David, I am providing this gift for you from the household of Mephibosheth. And when David asked him, where is Mephibosheth? Ziba accused Mephibosheth before David and said to him, Mephibosheth didn't come because he's happy that this is happening to you. He's happy that Absalom is doing this rebellion because he believes this is his opportunity to steal the kingdom from you and to take it back for the house of Saul, to take it back for an heir of Saul. And so during all this time that David's been in the wilderness, he believed the report of Ziba, and he concluded that Mephibosheth had been disloyal to him and had betrayed him. And he believed that Ziba, who brought him this needed gift of provision for the wilderness, had told him the true story and the true account. And so what he did for Ziba when Ziba brought him the gift is he said to him, here's my judgment as king. You now are in charge of all the lands that I have previously given to Mephibosheth. And he left it there and he went off into the wilderness. So all that's just been sitting there in that circumstance since David has left. And now he's returning. And as he returns across, as he's come right to the edge of the River Jordan, one of the very first people that meets him on the way back, without words, but with actions that demonstrate something important, is Ziba, this man who has accused Mephibosheth, and this man who has essentially asserted, I've been loyal to you, David, Mephibosheth hasn't been loyal to you. What was the manner in which Ziba came to meet him at the river? There are a couple of hints here in terms of his actions. One is, the passage tells us that Ziba hurried down. He rushed down to the River Jordan. Now, there's two possibilities here in terms of the way that he went to meet David at the river. One, he loved David dearly and was truly loyal to him in his heart, and he rushed down to the River Jordan to meet David because he was so thrilled and happy that the Lord had restored David to the kingship and had won the victory over Absalom, and he couldn't wait to embrace him and to have him back as king. That's one possibility. What other possibility could there be? He knows that he's told David a bold-faced lie that's now going to be exposed, leaving him vulnerable to the judgment of the king. And so he could be rushing down to the River Jordan in order to demonstrate to David by his service that, see, I really am loyal to you. No matter what you may hear about me, don't listen to it because my actions are speaking louder than anybody else's words. And so he rushes down to the River Jordan. And interestingly, not just by himself, he brings his whole family with him. He brings all of his servants with him. And they cross the River Jordan, the household of Ziba, cross the River Jordan repeatedly to help David and his company cross the River Jordan safely. In other words, they're doing the real grunt work of serving the king and the king's company as they return to the promised land. So, as David, the last you've heard is the account that Ziba gave to you. You haven't heard anything else. And now you see on your way home, who's the very first guy here to meet me? The first guy here to meet me is Ziba, just like he was one of the last guys to meet me as I left. He provided for me then, and look how wholeheartedly he is serving me and my practical needs and the needs of my household as he's repeatedly crossing the river. This is not an easy thing to do, to help us cross the river safely. The message that's sinking into David's heart is, this is Eba. He's a good guy, and he has my best interests at heart. Now, there's a problem here for David, of course. We'll come back to the chapter 19 again. Let's look over for a moment into the book of Proverbs. I read one verse from Proverbs 18 in our prior study. I want to reread that verse and add another verse to it. Proverbs 18. And this goes all the way back to the first message that he, the first encounter he had with Ziba on the way out of the city, but it also applies to this encounter with Ziba and with Mephibosheth as that's about to unfold. We're going to read Proverbs 18, verse 13, and then I'll skip down to verse 17. Proverbs 18:13 says, if one gives an answer before he hears, it is his folly and shame. If one gives an answer before he hears, the point here, the description here is, you're in a situation of responsibility, and you're going to need to render a judgment in this circumstance. You have to decide what the right thing is to do and what the wrong thing is to do. It's on your shoulders. You're the one in charge. You're making a decision. You're rendering judgment. How should you render judgment, and what should you avoid? Well, here, verse 13 very clearly describes that if you render the judgment before you've heard the full story, then you're going to be vulnerable to a judgment of folly, which will lead to shame. Be sure you know the full story before you render judgment. Let's look down in verse 17. The one who states his case first seems right until the other comes and examines him. Now here the picture is there's two men in a dispute, and there's a third unnamed man who is listening to the two and rendering judgment for the sake of the two, to decide between the two who's right and who's wrong in this situation. And in the circumstance, the first one that speaks presents an eloquent case on his own behalf and is convincing in telling the story from his perspective. And of course, in human nature, I think we understand enough about human nature, and we've experienced enough about human nature, both from our own selves and from experiences with others, that when we're in a situation like this where there's a dispute between two people and they're both telling a story and the first one speaks up and gives their whole story, that first person is going to naturally tend to tell the story in such a way as to make who look most favorable? Themselves. And then the point being here in the second part of verse 17, and the key, of course, is the key phrase in the first part is, seems right. The one who states his case first seems right. He may be right, or he may be wrong, but you can't judge based upon one side of the story, half of the facts, half of the account. You have to be able to judge righteous judgment. So the second one comes and examines him, meaning confronts, puts, you know, debates, disagrees, puts the story in a completely different light. And now, if you've already rendered judgment after the first half of the story alone, those are the type of judgments that are identified in this verse as, or in the previous verse, verse 13, as folly and shame. All right, so let's turn back then to chapter 19. And what we have here is a case in which David has heard the story of what has occurred between Ziba and Mephibosheth. Before verse 24 even happens, David has heard the story. Who has he heard the story from? Ziba. And only Ziba. He's heard a story from Ziba that Mephibosheth actually secretly was thrilled at the rebellion of Absalom because it would provide for himself an opportunity to regain the kingdom that had originally belonged to his grandfather. He described Mephibosheth to David as having a heart of rebellion, a heart of betrayal, essentially saying, Mephibosheth couldn't wait to stab you in the back, David. But I've been loyal to you, and I am loyally supporting you by the gift of these provisions on your way out of the city of Jerusalem. And then Ziba comes on his way back and serves him crossing the River Jordan without words, which is essentially a message to say, because if it's not a true story, this was Ziba's opportunity to do what? To throw himself on the mercy of the king and to say, O king, under the pressure of the circumstance, I took advantage of Mephibosheth and I lied and I portrayed him in the wrong light to you, and I deserve only your judgment, but I seek your mercy. He had that opportunity to come clean, to tell a different story to David. But by rushing down to the River Jordan to make sure he was first on the scene, the first one that David would see, and to serve in such an overt way by the multiple crossings of the River Jordan, what he's essentially saying by his actions is, what I said to you earlier is the true story. Don't listen to any other perspective about me. You can count on me. I'm true blue. I am your faithful servant. So that's what's being portrayed by Ziba. And then we read in verse 24, and Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king. Now what's missing in Mephibosheth's coming down that's different? What's distinct between him, his coming down, and Ziba's coming down? Ziba rushed. Mephibosheth didn't rush. But he did come down to meet the king. So there's a distinction there. And David can draw a conclusion about that. There's two possible conclusions. One is Mephibosheth didn't rush because he's not trying to deceive the king. Or the other is Mephibosheth didn't rush because he doesn't love the king to the same degree that Ziba did. So David is in a position now where he has to begin to evaluate and discern something that is not clear and obvious on the surface of these men's actions. This requires the righteous discernment and judgment of a king. You know, kings are placed, and while you and I are not kings, I do want us to see the connection and application for our own lives. While we're not in a kingship role, the Lord has placed each one of us as men in a role of authority. We each have differing measures of authority in our lives, but whatever authority we have, it's been granted by the Lord, and it represents the Lord's authority. Every responsible circumstance of authority that we operate in is an opportunity to represent the Lord's authority in the world around us. And David has a particularly high level of responsibility because he is the king of God's covenant people. He's representing the Lord's authority. So every time the king renders judgment, he is representing the Lord. And he's doing so either accurately and righteously, or he is misrepresenting the Lord's authority, as we just were recently studying in our last home church study about the calling that's upon all of our lives to represent the Lord's character and nature to the world around us. And so in this circumstance, it's very obvious just by the way these two men come to meet him. There's a distinction and there's a difference. And clearly I've gotten a full story on one side that's told me and kind of set my perspective in a particular direction. And now Mephibosheth comes down. What am I going to do about this? What am I going to conclude? How am I going to deal with this? And we have a description as Mephibosheth comes down. The description indicates that this was obvious. In other words, this wasn't something that David had to dig into and kind of sort through the stories. Just as Mephibosheth is approaching him, something becomes obvious about Mephibosheth. And that is his physical condition, his appearance. And what's described for us here are three elements. Mephibosheth had neither taken care of his feet. Now, this is going to sound funny, but literally what this means is He hadn't trimmed his toenails during the time that David had been gone from the city of Jerusalem. It might not be obvious for us. Most of us, I'm glancing around the room, most of us are wearing shoes. So if you had come to meet me today and had failed for weeks to trim your toenails, I wouldn't notice, and I wouldn't have any way of knowing unless you chose to tell me, "Tim, I just wanted to demonstrate my love for you. I haven't trimmed my toenails for months because I haven't seen you." That shows you how much I love you, how loyal I am to you. But for Mephibosheth and for the people of that culture and time and society, of course, they wore sandals. Their toenails were obvious. All right? So there's something as he's functioning in this circumstance where he's just showing up to meet David at the River Jordan. There's something that becomes obvious. He has not taken care of his feet. He has not trimmed his beard. You know, they all wore beards in that culture, but they appropriately trimmed the beard so that it would not be wild. And yet, Mephibosheth's beard has just grown without any trimming whatsoever. And he has not washed his clothes, which is probably the most obvious of the three things, maybe along with the beard as well. From the day the king departed until the day he came back in safety. Now, we do not know exactly how long David's been gone, but it's been at least weeks, possibly months. Now, there's been some period of time that he's been in exile, having fled from Absalom. And it's long enough, we could say this with certainty, that untrimmed toenails, an untrimmed beard, and unwashed clothes would be noticeable. You know, I might go a few days without washing clothes, but, you know, weeks becomes pretty obvious as in these days they didn't have, you know, multiple changes of clothing. He's apparently been wearing the same item of clothing for all this time, and it has not been washed in the meantime. So he shows up in this manner. And at one level, it might seem on the surface to be immediately disrespectful. Why? Well, this is the greatest dignitary in the nation that he's gone to meet. I mean, if you were invited to go meet with the President of the United States, would you be sure to take a few weeks before you respond to that invitation and intentionally not trim your toenails, trim your beard, and wash your clothes, and then show up like that with sandals on, untrimmed toenails, a wild beard, and dirty clothes? And here I am to meet the President of the United States. If you were to show up like that, you probably wouldn't even get close to him because the Secret Service would intervene and, you know, take you to a room off to the side, just because you would appear to be somewhat of a wild man, somewhat of an unbalanced individual. And that's really what's being presented here by Mephibosheth. This is not just a normal person in normal circumstances. There's something obviously and clearly going on with this individual. And David sees that, and David's not completely ignorant about these kinds of things. He understands the nature of these kind of things. What would this kind of behavior portray in that society? Mourning. It's a sign of what people did if they were mourning the death of some dearly loved one who had been lost to them. Now, Mephibosheth has experienced mourning. His own father, his grandfather, Jonathan, Saul have both died, but that's been some years now. And as far as we know, there's no other painful, heartfelt death that he's experienced in his family. He is mourning, but what is he mourning by this behavior? He's mourning the loss of the presence and relationship and fellowship of King David, who had mercifully embraced him when he didn't need to, and had mercifully provided him a home in his own palace, and had mercifully provided him a daily place at his own king's table. And Mephibosheth had taken full advantage of that in a good way, and has been present at the king's table every day since then, until David had to flee the city. And the question is that David has to discern, because he's been told by Ziba, Mephibosheth was really in his heart waiting for an opportunity to betray you all along. And the first opportunity that came, he did take it, used it to stab you in the back. That's what Ziba has said. But now, what do the actions of Mephibosheth say? Because the first one seems right when he gives his case until the second one comes and examines him. And while Mephibosheth isn't coming specifically to confront Ziba, his actions and his words, as David is about to ask him questions, his words and his actions say, you're not getting the full story, and what Ziba has told you is not true. And it's certainly not an accurate representation of what's going on in my heart, and this is not what's motivating me. So what we're needing to discern, whether David did accurately or not, we're needing to discern what's really the case here. And it is interesting to me that, you know, I've got a lot of good commentaries on David's life and some really rich, deep studies on the life of David that I study and I make use of to prepare these studies for you. And in the range of men who have studied this event, there's a wide range of difference of opinion about what's going on here. Some people think Ziba was a good guy and Mephibosheth was the bad guy. Some people think Ziba was the bad guy and Mephibosheth was the good guy. And some people think they're both bad guys. They both have mixed motives and they both are just out for themselves. And so here's David. All he can deal with is what he hears and what he sees and hopefully what the Lord reveals to him by discernment, because he will need to render judgment. And this is the key point that I want you to catch. When David renders judgment, he does at the end of this section. By the time we get to verse 30, David renders a judgment. When he renders judgment, he's not just exercising his own authority, as I mentioned earlier, he is representing the Lord's authority. So when he represents the Lord's authority, you better get it right. You don't want to misrepresent the Lord when the Lord is judge and you as judge have now just portrayed the Lord as a certain way in the eyes of the kingdom, because you're the king who represents the king of heaven and your actions is the one in charge, the one in authority, the one who has been placed in responsibility in this circumstance. So I told you there's a big difference of opinion. Of course, you'll want to know, well, what do I think about it? You've probably heard already, just by way of hints that I've given you in the way I've set the story up, I'm personally convinced that Ziba's a bad guy. Not necessarily the worst of the worst with bad guys. He's politically motivated. He's selfishly motivated. But he's a smart guy along with those selfish qualities. And he knows how to manipulate and maneuver and politically feather his own nest. And I see that that's what he's doing. I don't think he really cares whether David's the king or whether David's not the king, as long as he has been blessed under whatever rule happens to be the one that he has to deal with. And so he's maneuvering and manipulating, kind of like a Jacob character. He is manipulating in order to get the best circumstance for himself and his household. As far as Mephibosheth is concerned, I don't see him as a bad guy at all. I see him, interestingly enough, as portrayed here in this story, as a better man than David. A purer heart than David in this circumstance. First hint is his condition as he comes to meet David. The way he is. The untrimmed toenails, the untrimmed beard, the unwashed clothes. The detail that stood out to me in reading the story was the very last phrase of verse 24. This was his condition from the day the king departed until the day he came back in safety. That means literally the day David left, he stopped trimming his nails, his beard, and washing his clothes. Well, that wouldn't be very smart if his true motive, as Ziba had accused him of, was seeking an opportunity to steal the kingdom from David. The Because if he's seeking an opportunity to steal the kingdom from David, he's going to need to present himself to the community, to the society, as the next shining hero for them to choose to replace David. And they're not going to choose a long-toenailed, wild-beard, unwashed clothing man to be the next king. He's politically pulling the rug out from under his own feet, his own lame feet, by not presenting himself publicly in an attractive way, if his motive is political. Because as you know, in politics, it really matters how you look and how you present yourself politically and publicly to the community and to the society as a whole. Secondly, by showing overt and outward signs of mourning, while David had fled the city, he remained behind in the city of Jerusalem. He remained behind in the palace. Absalom came in and took over. He's actually saying by his actions, I miss David. It actually was putting his own life at risk. By mourning publicly the loss of David, it's saying to Absalom, you can't really trust this guy. He's loyal to your father, not to you. He risked being executed by Absalom with his actions. His actions were powerful. His public persona, his public portrayal was, I am loyal to David. I don't care if Absalom is taken over or not. And Absalom absolutely might have issued orders for his execution. And yet he took that risk to show his heart's mourning and loss of the fellowship of the king that he was truly loyal to. Now, his actions alone, to me, were enough of a message, if David had eyes to see and ears to hear, to help David to draw the right conclusion about whose story could really be believed here. And seeing Mephibosheth come to him in this way, it should have been enough for David to say to Mephibosheth, you know, Mephibosheth, I think I might have gotten you wrong. I heard a story from Ziba. Tell me your side of the story. That would have been the righteous thing for him to do and the wise thing. But what does David do as Mephibosheth comes? He immediately starts with a word of accusation showing that David has bought into the story that Ziba sold to him. He says to Mephibosheth at the end of verse 25, why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth? So essentially, David's playing the role here of, you know, I've been victimized by you. You know, you stabbed me in the back, Mephibosheth. Why weren't you loyal to me? Why did you betray me? He's taken his absence in his own exile as a Mephibosheth's absence in David's exile as a sign and an indicator that Mephibosheth really was looking for an opportunity to betray him and to stab him in the back. So this tells us something, which is that David has already violated the principle in Proverbs. He's rendered a judgment in his heart, even if he hasn't publicly proclaimed that or declared that judgment. He's rendered a judgment in his heart before he's heard the full story. He hasn't heard from both men. He hasn't heard both sides. He doesn't even know what Mephibosheth is going to say in his own defense. He's already concluded that he has not been loyal to him. Now, Mephibosheth does speak up, and his words to me are wonderful. It's a beautiful expression of a pure heart, a heart that has remained loyal, a heart that's remained steadfast during this trial. It is a trial for David. We've seen that. We understand that this is a trial that David's in, this whole sequence of circumstances. But understand this, when the king's in trial, the whole nation, in a sense, is under trial. The whole nation is going through a challenge and a testing time from the Lord. And so Mephibosheth is in his own trial. The king has been taken from him. His provider has been taken from him. The one who's given him a home in the palace, the one who's given him a seat at the king's table. All of that's been suddenly yanked away from him. And so where's his heart? His heart has remained steadfast. His heart has remained constant. His heart has remained loyal. So he asked him the question, you know, why didn't you go out with me? And here is his response. My Lord, O King, my servant deceived me. He's talking about Ziba now. My servant deceived me. For your servant said to him, I will saddle a donkey for myself that I may ride on it and go with the king. Essentially, he's saying, look, you know, he said to Ziba at some point, you know, when the king was leaving, I want to get on a donkey. I want to go with the king. And what we see in the earlier scene is Ziba riding up to the king on a donkey. And the conclusion we can now draw, putting two and two, both accounts together, is whose donkey did Ziba ride up to the king on? He rode up on Mephibosheth's donkey that Mephibosheth wanted to be on. And how could that happen? Well, Mephibosheth is lame. He would have needed help to even get on the donkey. And so Ziba just grabbed the donkey and took off on it with the supplies that were the present and the provision for the king. And the likely thing is that provision was probably also actually from Ziba's wealth. I mean, not Ziba's wealth, Mephibosheth's wealth. And it was probably the gift that he was going to take with him in the wilderness to provide for the king. And Ziba took that and took credit for that. And because Mephibosheth wasn't there to defend himself, left that impression in the mind of the king. So he said, you know, I wanted to go with you. I wanted to go on the donkey, but I'm lame. I wasn't able to do it. Verse 27, here's a direct thing. First he had said, he deceived me. Ziba deceived me. Now he says in verse 27, and he has slandered me to you, O king. But my lord, the king is like the angel of God. Do therefore what seems good to you. This is the affirmation of Mephibosheth's heart. In spite of all that's occurred, this is where I'm really at, king. This is where my heart's really at. I see you in a position of representing the Lord in my life. And so I'm trusting in your judgment in this circumstance. And whatever you decide, I'm good with, because the Lord has placed you in my life to serve this purpose. Now this takes trust on Mephibosheth's part, not just trust in David, but beyond David, trust in the Lord, because he knows that David's not perfect. He's just heard David falsely accuse him of betrayal to his own face. He knows David's capable, just as any man is, of being misled, drawing the wrong conclusion, rendering an unrighteous judgment. And yet he affirms to David, I'm willing to take that risk because you are in the role of the angel of God in my life. And the angel of God is simply a messenger directly from God. You know, you are God's message to me, and I am fine with whatever judgment you see fit to render in this case. And verse 28 gives his motive, his reason for having been able to reach that conclusion, that heart commitment to trust in the judgment of the king. For all my father's house were but men doomed to death before my lord the king. But you set your servant among those who eat at your table. What further right have I then to cry to the king? This is, you've seen this portrayed in some older movies maybe. You know, this is an old Far Eastern custom. If you save the life of a person that's doomed to death, then their life belongs to you from that point forward for the rest of your life. They have no rights of their own because they would have only been dead were it not for your intervention. But because you did intervene, they're now your loyal servant for the rest of their lives. And that's not from David's mouth to Mephibosheth. This is from Mephibosheth's mouth back to David, proclaiming, look, king, you saved my life. You had every right, and the normal pattern in society would have been, because I was the grandson of the king that you replaced, I expected to be put to death. I absolutely had no expectation to live another day. And yet you preserved me, and you did more than preserve me. You provided for me a place at your own table. How dare I complain to you about anything that happens in my life because of all you have done for me? I owe nothing but appreciation and thanks and gratitude to you, is the essence of his message. It's a wonderful, wonderful heart of pure motive, loyalty, integrity, and faith and faithfulness that is being proclaimed from Mephibosheth to David in this circumstance. Now, having heard that, what do you think the king would do or say? It should be obvious by now. It should be obvious exactly who is truly loyal to him between Ziba and Mephibosheth. But David, interestingly, in verse 29, it says, "Why speak any more of your affairs?" What this is it's a second level of accusation. It's basically an annoyance response. He's saying to Mephibosheth something along the lines of, "Look, this I'm coming back to the city of Jerusalem. Why are you bothering me with your personal business? Well, you know, you've talked enough about your personal business. I've got a kingdom to run here," is the essence of how he's responding to him. He doesn't respond to him with a gracious response. He doesn't respond to him in the way that he should. He doesn't respond to him with a heart that is displaying clear and righteous discernment and judgment. This is what I want to describe as an evidence of a heart of clouded judgment. Now, when we talk about clouded judgment, what we're essentially describing is a judgment that has been influenced by unhealthy factors within our own hearts. We're in a position of responsibility. We're in charge. We're called to render a decision, make a determination, render a judgment. But because of issues in our own minds and hearts that are not healthy with the Lord, then when it comes time to render that judgment, I'm not seeing things as clearly as I should. So my judgment is clouded. And therefore, my judgments are not going to represent the Lord as clearly and accurately as they should. So he says, "Why speak any more of your affairs? I have decided." He didn't even let Mephibosheth really finish. That's it. I made a decision. And his decision was not entirely bad for Mephibosheth. He says, "You and Ziba shall divide the land." Just brief backstory. Originally, David himself gave all the land to Mephibosheth. Then when Ziba lied and deceived the king and accused falsely Mephibosheth of betrayal, he took all of the land from Mephibosheth that he had previously given to him. He unrighteously stole the inheritance, David did, from Mephibosheth and gave it all to Ziba. Now that he's heard Mephibosheth's defense, what does he do? What should he do at this point? What he should do is take all of it back from Ziba, who's only lied and deceived, deal with Ziba according to what he deserves, and give it all back to Mephibosheth and appoint a new and wiser, more loyal, and more trustworthy steward to run the affairs of his household for him. But he doesn't do that. He splits the land. He makes a compromise decision. But the compromise isn't between you're partly right and he's partly right, you're partly wrong, he's partly wrong, so I'm going to give half to each of you. This isn't a case of one man being partly right and the other man being partly right. This is a case of one man being completely right and the other man being completely wrong. And so his judgment was an unwise, unrighteous, clouded judgment. Now, there's one last thing in the story, which is, I think, the Lord's graciousness to David, but he misses it. As on occasion, he misses the Lord's graciousness in other key moments of his life as well. What happens when David renders this judgment is Mephibosheth says one brief statement about the judgment that's just been rendered. And in his brief response, we have a second clue. The first clue that should have caught David's attention was the physical appearance of Mephibosheth when he came to meet David at the river. But now, in Mephibosheth's final words, this should have confirmed to David's heart, "I have wrongly judged Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth said to the king, "Oh, let him take it all, since my lord, the king, has come safely home." If Ziba is told the truth, and if Mephibosheth is only selfishly, deceitfully, unfaithfully, disloyally looking for opportunity to betray the king, then that kind of heart is not going to graciously accept the theft of half of your wealth and property and lands. He's going to say something. He's going to protest. He's going to try to argue his case further. He's going to try to convince the king. But there's a sincere acceptance on his part, because he really does believe what he has just previously said. I deserve to die. So anything that I receive from the king is grace to me, and I'll accept it as grace. It's kind of like the attitude we all should have as those whose lives were doomed to eternal destruction and were rescued by the Son of David, by the Messiah, by our Savior, when we deserved only his judgment and he gave us instead his grace and mercy in our salvation. And the attitude we should have from that point forward: whatever you have planned for me after that, Lord, is fine with me, because I deserve only death and destruction and your judgment. And any good thing that I get, any good thing that I receive, any blessing after that is icing on the cake of my life. Thank you, Lord. I'm at peace with that. I'm good with that. I'm content with that. I'm not going to struggle with that. That's where Mephibosheth's heart is truly at. And that should have sealed the deal for David's wavering, clouded judgment. That should have like flipped a final switch in his perspective to say, I got this wrong. And he should have right then corrected himself and should have said, having heard those words from your heart, I now understand your true heart's motive fully. And I am changing my judgment. And I'm taking everything from Ziba, giving it all back to you, and I will deal with Ziba separately. We don't know for sure why David chose to compromise in the way that he did. Might have been pride. The fact that he took half of it from Ziba. If he's going to believe Ziba's story, don't give any to Mephibosheth. Yet he gives half and half. Might have been just, you know, I don't want to look bad in this situation, so I'll just split it between the two of them. And it might have been political, because Ziba is an influential man in the society. A man with that many children and that many servants under his control. A man who had such an influential position in the house and the tribe of Benjamin. Certainly was someone that David now is trying to return to Jerusalem. The whole nation's been in rebellion. He's trying to consolidate his kingdom. Maybe he was politically motivated to an extent of, you know, I just don't want to make waves on my way back into the city here. We don't know for sure whether it was pride, politics, or some mix, but whatever it was, it didn't represent the Lord's judgment in the way that the king should represent his judgment. And in this regard, David serves as an object lesson for us, just like he does in each one of the other events of his life. As I mentioned before, we are all placed in positions of responsibility and authority. We have many opportunities that the Lord gives us, testing circumstances in which we have to look, and we don't know the full story. We don't know exactly what's going on. And we have to look at the clues. We have to look at the hints that the Lord provides for us. And if we're still stuck at the end of that, we always have access to do one thing that David could have done, but again, at a key and critical moment, failed to do, as he has a few other key moments in his life. What could he have done at this moment? If he's still just not 100% sure who's telling the true story, could have prayed. Could have stopped right there. Lord, you know between these two men. You know. Now, I believe the Lord had already given him enough in the appearance of Mephibosheth and the heart response of Mephibosheth to his unrighteous judgment. I think David had enough. But even so, if he just, I just am not sure and I don't want to render the wrong judgment, he could have cried out to the Lord even at that moment And I believe the Lord would have been gracious and would have been just to provide to him the confirmation of how to deal with the circumstance. All right, we'll stop there, and we will pick up, Lord willing, with the final two encounters next week or next month in our next men's breakfast. God bless you, men.